Hi guys, good morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and welcome back to Teachable Psych. My name is Sarah Jane, your host, and this month's episode explains further on educational psychology and how teacher-student relationships play a big role and impact on kids' educational environment. Now, this professor is Robert Panotta, who works at University of Virginia, and I'm so delighted we were able to speak with him and learn more on this topic. Now, I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I do, and I'll see you at the end.
I'm Bob Pianta. I'm a professor at the University of Virginia in the School of Education and Human Development.
So can you tell us a little bit how you began this field and why you chose to continue in it?
I've been interested in the relationships that teachers form with their students since I was a teacher. I think I was probably interested in it when I was a student too, because I had some teachers that I ended up being quite close to, and they were important role models for me and influences in my life. I first was a teacher in special education for middle school students. And I had the chance to teach the same students for 3 years in a row. And that was a very unique experience and actually enabled me to form this connection with them, which I realized was different than what other teachers, the kind of opportunity that many other teachers had because they only saw the kids for 9 months. Mm-hmm. And after teaching, I went to graduate school and in the study of psychology and education, sort of the connection between psychology and education, and was fortunate enough to work on a research project. This was just kind of lucky, really, that studied relationships between parents and children. And from that, I learned a lot about the theory behind adult-child relationships. And from there, I knew that's what I wanted to study.
Awesome. Can you tell us a little bit about the theory you just mentioned?
Yeah, it's a well-known theory called, it's basically called attachment theory. It focuses on the emotional bonds that children form with their caregivers. And so this is the theory built up around, actually it was built up by John Bowlby after World War II, when many children in England were separated from their parents. And he observed the consequences of separation and loss, and then some of the aspects of the emotional connections that children had with their parents. And that then informed a whole research enterprise, really, that many of my teachers at the University of Minnesota, where I was at graduate school, were exploring in their own research. And so I began to work on that project and immediately saw the connections between the kinds of things that they were studying and talking about in attachment theory, these bonds between kids and adults and how the bonds are formed and how they help support the student's development. I saw the connection between those relationships and what I had experienced as a teacher and observed. And so from that began to, you know, explore what the transfer of knowledge and tools and ways of studying relationships could be to the study of teacher-student relationships.
No, that's very important. Could you tell us a little bit how the field has grown since you entered it and what's changed for good or bad?
Yeah, sure. The study of teacher-student relationships has grown dramatically, I think, over the course of the last 20, even 30 years from I think what had been acknowledged as an important phenomenon in education, people always said these relationships are important, but we didn't have too many tools to study them. We didn't have a scientific framework really to study them in, and we didn't have a lot of data, you know, evidence that they were important. And so one of the first things we did, and we were not the only ones to do this, there were other people doing this as well at about the same time, this would be, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, were to develop some measurement systems. So our team developed some ways of having teachers describe their relationships with children. We developed a questionnaire. We also developed an interview system. Again, these were work that had been done with parents, but then trying to take it and tailor it to an educational context and some of the limits on a relationship between a teacher and a student that are different than a parent and their child. We also developed some ways of observing teacher-student interactions that grew very dramatically. They were on this measurement system that we developed to observe relationships was adopted by many systems for early care and education, preschool in the United States. And that really helped the field kind of have a set of known tools to use and study. And as our team and many other teams included these and other tools for assessment in their research programs, what we began to learn was, oh, the qualities of this relationship are important for students' academic achievement. They're important for students' attendance. They're important for their motivation and their engagement. And they're not just important for little kids who are preschoolers and kindergartens. They actually are important in high school. And you can ask high schoolers about their relationships with teachers, and those predict to their learning and their engagement in school. So you begin to see the kind of the flowering of the field and the refinement of knowledge and tools. So we, our team, and then again, some other teams develop some ways of intervening with teachers to work with them to improve their relationships with students. And then lo and behold, we found that you could improve relationships, and that if you did improve relationships, the students in those teachers' classrooms learned, you know, so the growing evidence base, I think, became a very powerful tool for moving these ideas into practice, you know, in many places. For example, in the whole state of Louisiana, they measure the quality of early child care settings using our observation tool that looks at interactions between teachers and students and the relationships they have. So there are many places, not just in the United States, but also around the world. One of the things that's been kind of exciting about this has been how much research is going on in other places around the world. So we have, you can see examples of people doing research on teacher-student relationships in a number of countries in Europe, Italy, Spain. There's a lot of work being done in Belgium and the Netherlands right now. There's teams there that are doing this. I'm giving a set of talks in Norway and the Scandinavian countries. There's also work being done in Australia. There's a couple of colleagues in China that are doing really terrific research, and many colleagues in South America. So it's just kind of growing. And I think there's also a growing sense of the value of relationships as we're coming out of the pandemic, and people have missed those connections in ways and understood their value in a different way. And I think there's also a growing recognition that the kind of standards-based reform and accountability and testing kids about their, you know, every fact that they could possibly memorize has reduced education in a way to an experience, has reduced the experience of kids' education and their motivation to engage, and that we have to broaden that and include some of these relational factors. So I think the public is beginning to shift. Students' voices have been super important about that in talking about the value of relationships.
Well, yeah, that's terrific. Regarding your statement on COVID, do you think there's been a big shift or like a difference in like student-teacher relationships were prior or after COVID?
Well, if you talk to a lot of students, they will tell you that they changed. I think we don't have, we have achievement data on kids nationally. So I'm going to see some of all these reports that are in the New York Times or, newspapers that are describing declines in literacy scores or math scores pre-COVID to post-COVID. We don't measure teacher-student relationships in the same way at the same scale. So we can't say, oh, pre-COVID, kids felt this way about their relationships with teachers, and now post-COVID, they feel a different way. We have to do it more on smaller samples and kind of anecdotal reporting. But certainly, if you talk to some of the people that have done some survey results, there are some pretty good national surveys that describe students' feelings about school and the how much they realize the value of their relationships with their teachers and how great it's been to be back in person, to be able to have and form those connections.
Yeah, I can say the same thing. Being online is not the most fun for learning.
Yeah. I think what it's starting, all this is starting to point out it, that we also need to do a better job helping teachers in as when we train them in universities to train them with relationships as a focus of that training, as much as we train them to teach social studies or math, we also need to teach them about forming relationships with kids.
Yes, for sure. You're saying how you are also working with other interventions in foreign countries. And do you think culture makes the way that they do these specific interventions differently than we do in the United States?
That's a fantastic question. I know that it does and it doesn't, and we don't know the limits right now. You know, we don't know how much overlaps and how much doesn't.
Yeah.
So for example, I mentioned this tool we use to observe teacher-student interactions and relationships in classrooms. We just published a study that looked at data from 36 other countries. Now, most of them are Western European countries, so it's hard to compare, and it's a little bit, you know, it's not exactly great comparison. So I wouldn't use this as a comparison, but I would say that the tool that was developed in the United States, and we have a pretty diverse set of cultures in the United States too, so any tool that works here has to work across a breadth of backgrounds for kids and families. The tool can be used in the same way. You know, there aren't people haven't said that it's not applicable, mm-hmm. you know, in these countries. People can agree on what they see. They can describe classrooms in the ways that we have described them in the tool. But we just don't have enough research right now to know what are the kind of nuances in culture that would cause one to want to adapt or modify, you know, certain aspects of a relationship. And we certainly don't know whether some features of a relationship are more important in one culture than they are in another. We don't know that yet.
So you were speaking on pre-K and preschool and also on high school. What do you think is the biggest difference or similarity between the different age groups?
Well, one of the biggest differences, as we've looked at it, is the way in which teachers of younger students play a much more active role in fostering students' motivation, their engagement, their learning of skills. The teachers have they certainly feel a great responsibility for teaching, you know, for putting together activities and helping ensure that kids are learning some foundational skills. In the upper grades, teachers have to make the transition between being in control and in charge and giving kids more autonomy and responsibility for their own learning. And that shift for teachers is a very difficult one to make sometimes. And that, to me, is the biggest challenge. That's what teachers will tell us when we work with them around their interactions and relationships with students. When we work with high school teachers, we will try to encourage them oftentimes to recognize the student's interests and follow the student's interests rather than what's in the lesson,
yeah.
for example. And they will say, oh, that's very hard.
Yeah.
It's very hard for me to do because it means I have to give up my control of the lesson. Not control in a bad way, but just what they feel they should be doing.
Correct.
So it's important to help teachers manage that shift to giving more autonomy to students at every age, but it really shows up in middle school and high school.
Yeah. So when you guys research on these group of teachers, do you take into account how big their classroom size is and or categorize it by like their subject that they're teaching versus social studies and math, which can be completely different?
Yeah, we when we look at middle school and high school, actually in any grade, when we do observations or when we survey students, when we interview teachers, we ask the teachers always about their educational level, some of things about their attitudes. We ask them about their philosophy of teaching and things like class size, the support they get in the school, things like that. And then we also ask the teacher, we observe or ask the teachers, you know, what the subject area is that they're teaching, things like that. And again, what we found is that the features of relationships are important across all those subject areas. Like there isn't a math relationship and a language arts relationship. The features of relationships are consistent across those, the ones that are important for kids and for teachers. And when we focus with teachers and help them improve those aspects of their relationships, kids' achievement goes up, whether it's in math, whether it's in science, whether it's in history.
That's amazing. So I was fortunate enough to also speak with Jan Blancher. Could you talk a little bit about the research that you guys did together?
Yeah, she's doing some really interesting work. Jan is doing some very interesting work with students with disabilities and helping teachers understand kids' cues for responding, you know, and how teachers can sensitively engage students with disabilities, with their parents, and focus on the relational qualities of their work with students rather than just focus on the skills that they're trying to teach the students. And I think it's, again, not surprising, you know, it's one more element of diversity is students with disability. And we're finding that many of the same kind of things that are important for teachers of typically developing kids are important for teachers of atypically developing kids. Kids display their cues differently. Typically developing kids and atypically developing kids have different sets of cues, but they still display cues in a way that require, in a relationship, require the adult to respond sensitively and in a timely fashion to those cues.
Yeah, this is a pretty broad question, so you can take it how you'd like. Now, how is education correlated and or associated with psychology?
Well, there's a whole lot of ways where education is associated with psychology. There's all the theories of learning that students' development and growth, particularly cognitive development growth, have informed a lot of educational practice. Theorists like Piaget and Skinner and have been important historically in understanding kids' learning. Now there's very big field of cognitive science. When we talk about the science of learning and the science of reading, that's a lot of psychologists have done that work. A lot of it now in collaboration with educators, which is good. And then another area of connection between psychology and education is in tests and measurements. That's been a huge connection between psychology and education. Psychology's helped develop, many of the kinds of cognitive tests and achievement tests that are used in helping understand kids' learning and learning disabilities or abilities are all have some roots in psychology. I think we're moving toward a place, which I think is good, of greater connection. The study of child development and the emphasis on understanding kids' development within contexts, within a home or within a school, within out-of-school contexts, on the part of psychologists studying child development, have really opened up this connection between the child development studies and educational studies. And so we're seeing more and more ways in which research crosses over between those two that you can't tell what's education and what's psychology, because it's all
when compared with like other foreign countries, how do you think their structure of their like educational board differs, or something that we could learn from in the United States?
That's a really good question. Well, a lot of the European countries, actually, almost all other countries that we have worked with have a national curriculum that and that teachers are trained in public universities to teach a consistent national curriculum that is assessed using a set of national tests. Sometimes those go into very, very high stakes kind of results for students that can be challenging for those students. It kind of open up close opportunity, but the coupling of a standard curriculum with training and delivery of that curriculum and professional development and coaching around how to do that curriculum really well and how to assess the results of teaching that curriculum, having all that sort of put together in one package is a feature of most every other education system in the world. In the United States, we have at least 50, different versions of that. If you think of the state level, but even within a state, we have what's called local control, where local school boards make most of those decisions, and even in local school boards, will defer many of those decisions to the principal and staff of a school, so that within even a school division, you could have reading taught one way in one classroom and another way in another classroom.
Do you think it would benefit us if our educational board was more uniform across all the states?
I do. I tend to think that that's the case. We saw some movement in that direction 15 years ago or so under Barack Obama's presidency, with this move toward Common Core, which was going to be a common set of standards across all of the 50 states that would help drive, a consistent curriculum framework across states and consistent sets of measurements across states. But that kind of unraveled in kind of predictable ways and so we could moved back to some version of local control. Although again, you see, for example, New York City right now is instituting a consistent approach to teaching reading across the entire school system. It's the largest school system in the country, city school system. So, I think people recognize the importance of a common framework and a common approach to instruction, and the importance of teachers being able to tailor that approach to individual kids' needs. But nonetheless, the teacher's been trained to deliver a common approach. And I think we have this, we have a lot of energy in this, our education system, tied up in the tension between this common approach and a local approach. And we haven't resolved that. And it's kind of a waste of energy, honestly, because we could use that to actually help kids learn more, I think.
So one of the things you mentioned was assessments and like aptitude testing. So how do you think we could improve like students, or like the way teachers teach students how to take tests, how it could benefit them, rather than some kids who are so caught up in like, oh, I'm not a good test taker, and it ruins their potential that they could achieve?
Right. Well, I think we probably place too much emphasis on what we call high stakes tests, and where, you know, teachers get failing grades if their kids don't, you know, pass the test or the school is, you know, rated poorly, things like that. I think there are many, many more efforts now in what's called formative assessment, where kids are providing data about their performance on a regular basis over the course of the year. The teachers are using that information about the kids' learning to chart their growth and to tailor the instruction to the student so they can learn, okay, this is the next thing for you to make a move on. You need help in this. I need to spend more time with you on this. Or these are a set of activities. So we're moving, and I think this is where, technology platforms, what we call adaptive assessments. These are the kind of formative and adaptive assessments. Even AI, I think, can be helpful here, where we could use those to tailor instruction to children's individual needs in a much more nuanced way that I hope will take some of the tension out of testing, and it becomes less a tool for deciding whether you can go to college or not, and much more a tool for you to improve your learning pathways and trajectories.
I know in some European countries, their education curriculums really focus on doing projects together rather than having homework. Do you think that would benefit students here?
Oh, absolutely. I think, it's like we were talking about earlier about, kids' motivation and having some voice in their education and responsibility. I think it's amazing to me to see the energy and activity and motivation and the learning that goes on when students are given something that's relevant and interesting to them to work on. And it can be super hard. Many times they will learn that without a whole lot of instruction because they'll figure out because they really want to learn. And I think the more we can build educational environments where that kind of learning can occur, I think we're going to really open up educational opportunity for all kids in a way that can really be a positive move, I think.
Yeah. I know you also study like kindergarten in the younger ages. So for that age range, do you think it would benefit classroom settings if there was like 2 to 3 teachers at a time rather than 1 over 30 kids?
Yeah, I have been intrigued by the idea that we could take one of the things we do, I think this is particularly true in the early grades, we provide a lot of services to kids who are identified for needing help for one reason or another, which is fine. Those kids need extra help. But the way we do that oftentimes is we take a child out of a classroom of 25 and work with them individually, and we take another child out or work with 2 or 3 of them. And so there are a lot of very trained, highly trained adults that walk around a school in any given day. And I have often thought that we could, if we took all of those highly trained adults, and instead of class size being 20 or 25, we gave everybody, every one of those trained adults, 10 students to work with. So we divided the total number of kids in a school among all the trained adults in the school and grouped them differently. Rather than 25 and 1 or 2, everybody had 10. I think we would see much more fruitful ways of teachers being able to engage kids and engage the differences of kids. And in the end, we would reduce tremendously the need for so much specialized service, because then the kids who really need it will probably still need to get the group of 2 or 3. But the kids who are not doing well in a group of 20 or 25 will probably do just fine in a group of 10.
Yeah. You know, I know for younger ages, the kids' parents are more involved. How do you think that affects the way teachers have to interact with their students and their parents?
Well, I think it's always good for parents to be involved in their children's education. Sometimes, there's great variety in that. Sometimes there's parents want to know everything that's going on. If there was a video of the classroom, they have the video. And other times it's very hard to engage parents for any number of reasons. They're working, you know, cultural barriers and the like. But I don't think there's any doubt that bringing parents into their students' learning, having them understand what students are learning, giving them suggestions as to how they can support and reinforce that at home, how they can support the teachers' work with their students, is a really positive thing. And this is particularly true in the younger years. And for many kids, it's important so that parents can actually be aware of the resources that are available in a school and advocate for their student. That's a very important thing, particularly for parents for whom cultural barriers might be challenging for them to navigate.
Hi guys, and welcome back. Thank you so much again to Professor Panotta for speaking with us and giving us more insight into this topic. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Have a good rest of your morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and I'll see you next time.